to remember April 19, 1995, not merely because great evil appeared that day, but because goodness overcame evil that day.
Vice President Dick Cheney speaking earlier today at a memorial service for the victims of the Oklahoma City bombing 10 years ago today. Welcome back to Issues Etc. here in the third hour. We're going to start out talking with Paul Coughlin on the occasion of the 10th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Then, in about 25 minutes, we're going to be talking with Pastor Paul McCain and get a Lutheran perspective on the election of Pope Benedict XVI that took place earlier today. Paul Coughlin is a regular guest here on the program. He's a former newspaper editor and radio talk show host, and he's authored this book, Secrets, Plots, and Hidden Agendas, What You Don't Know About Conspiracy Theories. Paul, welcome back.
Hey, Todd, it is great to be back with you. Thank you.
We've talked a lot about conspiracy theories. What role did conspiracy theories play in the Oklahoma City bombings and in the lives of Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols?
Well, it played everything. I mean, they wouldn't have gone through with it if they didn't believe in this, what we would call a New World Order conspiracy, very similar to what you'll find in the Left Behind series. But for the McVeigh and Nichols, they didn't believe that to be fiction. They believed it to be fact. So they believed that this large, global, international, powerful group of people in the media, in banking, and obviously in the military are out to, kill or at least quiet God-fearing Americans who wish to, in the case of McVeigh and Nichols, who wish to bear arms, and they wish and they want to do that, but they feel that people are trying to take that away. So it has these. If it weren't for their end of the world, New World Order conspiracy theories, very likely we wouldn't have seen that bombing.
So are you saying that everyone who buys into a conspiracy theory like that is going to commit a terrorist act like the Oklahoma City bombing?
No. I contend that there are millions of people who actually believe in these conspiracy theories, but there was something in McVeigh and Nichols that made them actually act upon it. Two of the things that made them act upon it were the government mistakes at both Ruby Ridge and at Waco. That convinced both McVeigh and Nichols that the government indeed was out to attack God-fearing Christians who according to them, they just wanted to be left alone and live out their beliefs.
Paul, why are Christians, I don't know, more than other people, or I don't know whether they outstrip the rest of the population, but why do Christians seem particularly susceptible to believing in and buying into conspiracy theories, especially these grand ones, a la Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols?
That's a great question, because as we both know, the far left has its conspiracy theories too, but there is something with the far left. They're not quite as adamant. I mean, you got Michael Moore, who is adamant, don't get me wrong, but there is something on the far right that exists in most cases most of the time that doesn't exist on the far left, and that is this religious underpinning, what the far right would call a Christian underpinning, which I disagree with. They have this religious underpinning that is tied blood-stopping tight to end-times prophecy. And when I say end-times prophecy, I'll be a little more specific. Popular and contemporary end-times prophecy as compared with the Bible prophecy that most Christians have viewed through most of the time. These Christians contend that when Jesus' discourse in Matthew 23 and 24, for most of Christian history, it has been interpreted that Jesus was talking about the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. He was prophesying about that. But around, I believe, the middle 1700s, a man named Darby brings to America this whole other view that, no, when Jesus is talking about the coming destruction, he is talking about a future generation. And more than that, he is talking about a generation that has yet to even live on the earth, yet for many, many generations past. So that's why you have this concern by many Christians. Again, the Left Behind series is an excellent example. There are many people who take that fiction and, sure, change the names and all that sort of stuff, but they are absolutely convinced that what is outlined in that Left Behind series is gospel fact, you just change the names a bit.
Now, there are Christians, say, within the last, someone who might be 40 years and under, there are Christians for whom the conspiracy theories, at least in their minds, are inextricably bound up with the Christian faith. They cannot imagine Christianity apart from, well, there's going to be a one-world government, there's going to be a one-world order, the Illuminati have been doing this for centuries, and the various other groups have been doing that for centuries. And they cannot imagine the Christian faith. They simply do not know what the Christian faith would look like without their conspiracy theory.
Absolutely true. Here I am in Southern Oregon, and I tell you what, if you want to get into an argument with, a devout Christian, particularly of the evangelical persuasion, go ahead and say that you doubt some of their views of end times prophecy. And they will, well, I personally have been accused of being evil for saying these things, appearing on radio stations across the country. I've been accused of being evil. I've been accused of not even being a Christian when I basically say that, hey, listen, this isn't even the historical view of Bible prophecy. You're absolutely right. These conspiracy theories, and you have it with the Weaver family on Ruby Ridge, these conspiracy theories become a religion in and of themselves. I contend that they become a para-religion. And after a while, these Christians, the scriptures only are really relevant and important and worth studying after a while, only in as much as they help you figure out when the end of the world is going to take place and who gets whisked away and who doesn't. So it actually has a way of stealing their faith. Randy Weaver later admitted to Time magazine that after his family was shot and all those horrible things happened there in Idaho with his family, that he wasn't even sure he was a Christian. And that's a great point, because I don't think he is either. He turned into a, basically his mindset and his beliefs were far more cultic than they were Christian.
So the Bible comes to serve the theory rather than the other way around.
Yeah, and of course we need to be careful. That doesn't happen for everyone, obviously. Not everyone wants to take up arms against what they consider to be a New World Order. But it has that ability to take over a person's mind. And, here I am, Paul Coughlin, so people don't even know who I am. I've written a book about these conspiracy theories and been interviewed by, C-SPAN and all that. But basically they're not going to listen to me. So let me quote Chuck Swindoll. When he brought up this topic under an excellent series that he did on Bible prophecy, and he ended it with a very, very strong warning, and you can find it in my book, he said, there's something about the prophetic message that has the ability to consume a person's mind, and often very bright people get consumed by this, and it becomes a well that they can't dig themselves out of. Timothy McVeigh, he was not a dumb guy. He was, smart in some ways. Terry Nichols wasn't quite as smart as Timothy McVeigh. We like to believe that the people who believe in these things are really just easily duped. And I guess on one hand we would say that they are, but we need to be very careful because the prophecy angle has the ability to really own someone. And, frankly, we're playing with fire, so we need to be very careful.
What do we know of the details of the theory that was driving Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols? Do we know, you've looked at all the theories, you know all the various, how they inbreed, how the hybrid theories develop and things like that. Do you know of the details that Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols were buying into?
There are some details there, and there's also some details that have yet to be fully understood, given their connection to the Elohim city that they at least frequented, if not called, a few weeks before the Oklahoma City bombing. We know that they adhered, they were part of a larger circle, but it's been very difficult to piece together with certainty exactly who else was involved and other things of that nature. We don't want to believe that one or two or three people, Michael Fortier would be the third person, could actually plan such a horrific assault upon American soil, but the facts remain that at least at that time, it's been tightened up since then, but the facts remain that it wasn't that hard to put together a fertilizer bomb and to get the components of a bomb that would create such widespread destruction. Like I said, security has been tightened up on these components to make a fertilizer bomb like that. But back then, it wasn't as hard to find.
Do we know whether or not Timothy McVeigh, before he was executed, or Terry Nichols to this day, serving life sentences, are still adherents to the theories that drove them to do their crime?
We don't know for sure, though. I guess, Terry, we don't really know with Timothy McVeigh as much. You know, I tried to interview him before he was executed, and I never heard back. Because I too, probably like you, Todd, and probably like a lot of the listeners, wanted to know exactly what he believed, because he was kind of a blank page in some respects. I mean, he gave some interview. There's anecdotal information, like a person in his marriage, or rather a person during his wedding, said that Timothy McVeigh thought that this whole New World Order thing that he saw was a fulfillment of Bible prophecy. So we have some testimony in that respect, but we don't have as much as we would like. At least with Timothy McVeigh, he went to the grave carrying more thoughts than he didn't reveal as many thoughts as I would have liked to have seen. I would have liked to have known, who was he listening to? What books did he read? We know that he read the Turner Diaries, but I wanted to know from a biblical, or rather from a religious standpoint, what exactly were the religious thoughts that went through his head? Again, we have some understanding of it. I would have liked to have known more. Terry Nichols recently wrote a letter to Fox News, not so much outlining his ideas so much as saying that there are other people part of this of the Oklahoma City bombing. So there's still, we may find more out from Terry Nichols.
Isn't it ironic, though? But the irony can hardly be, I mean, it's not just sad, it's tragic irony, that men who believed firmly in a conspiracy theory ended up in their criminal acts conspiring to commit this crime.
Yeah, the world is full of paradoxes, isn't it? And, you know, we had it too with David Koresh there at Waco. You know, he was a huge conspiracy theorist. Essentially, you know, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. He believed the federal government was out to go get him. So, and it made sense, and he probably had foreknowledge of that. Why? Because he was amassing products through the U.S. mail that people aren't supposed to be able to own. He was doing hand grenades. He was purchasing equipment to make automatic weapons. I mean, these things are illegal, at least at the time. And so here he was saying, hey, the government's out to get me. He's doing things that make the government want to get him. And then he turns around and says, hey, look, I was right all along. And that is, unfortunately, that's the mindset and that's the life of too many cult leaders and the gullible people who follow them.
Talk about, and we've discussed this many times before, two aspects of the conspiracy theorist. One is the kind of impregnable, when they're deep into it, the mind becomes impregnable to any contrary evidence.
Yeah.
Begin there.
What happens with I would consider this to be a hardcore conspiracy theorist. I put conspiracy theorists on a spectrum. You got the mild, medium, and heavy, large conspiracy theorist. And with the large conspiracy theorist, they're really very difficult to reach. They are transmitters. They're not receivers. They will listen to you only in as much as you will confirm their beliefs. And then when you start tugging at their beliefs with contrary information, as the scriptures say, a person's testimony sounds convincing until it's cross-examined. So you go to cross-examine them, I've done well over 10 years now, because I was concerned about these things well before the Oklahoma City bombing. And so tug on these beliefs, and they'll handle it for a while, and then eventually the gloves will come off. They have a lot of invested interest in these conspiracy theories being true. And if you want to put information to the contrary, they simply will not hear it. And that's why it makes me think that the people who are really deep in conspiracy theories, I got to wonder whether they're really interested in truth. I think they're interested in ridding the world of ambiguity. Conspiracy theories offer a very coherent world, even if the answer is horrible. Even if the answer is yes, all the major players in your government are really out to get you. For some people, that is a less frightening concept than thinking that there's some things we just don't know why they happen, and that they're out of our control, and, you know, we're kind of a pawn in a game, so to speak. So it's the ambiguities I think many conspiracy theorists just don't want, and so they create what is essentially an alternative universe to rid the world of them.
The other aspect of this is the isolation that the conspiracy theory can create between the person who holds it and virtually everyone else and everything else in their lives. The scenario kind of plays it out in this downward spiral of, well, if you don't believe my theory, you might be ignorant. But maybe at some future point, I might decide that you're an unwitting pawn in the conspiracy, or maybe even complicitous, or maybe at some point I might have to conclude that you're an active participant. And pretty soon I'm not going to have anything to do with you because you're part of the plot.
And I've been accused of all those things as well when I speak out against these dangerous conspiracy theories. That's why I refer to these ideas as being cultic. They share many of the qualities of a cult, one of them being the having official sources of information. You will talk with a conspiracy theorist, and you'll say, well, where did you get that information from? And they'll have their newsletters that they read. Don McElvaney is probably one of the bigger ones, at least at one time. And you'll go, well, I don't know if that's a credible source of information because, you know, I read in the Wall Street Journal that, this was the case with that event. Well, you cannot quote the Wall Street Journal, according to them, because they're part of the conspiracy. Now, keep in mind, it's probably one of the more conservative newspapers in the nation. They have their official sources of information, and if you come up with stuff that disagrees with them, they've got a very convenient answer, don't they? Well, those people are part of the conspiracy. Essentially, the difficulty of reaching a conspiracy theorist when they go to the hardcore level is they've always got an answer. And you can come up with answers all day long, as I have, and they'll always fall back to their Trump position. Either you're part of the conspiracy or you're duped. To some degree, they have to have that conspiracy theory to be true. Because if that conspiracy theory goes down the tubes, so does their view of the world. And for some, I think that it's too frightening.
If you have a question or a comment on conspiracy theories and the Oklahoma City bombing on the 10th anniversary of that tragic event, call now, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Paul Coughlin is our guest, a former newspaper editor and radio talk show host and author of the book Secrets, Plots, and Hidden Agendas, What You Don't Know About Conspiracy Theories. Steve, calling from his car, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hey, good afternoon, and very interesting show. I was flicking through the radio channels this morning, and there was some commentary about the anniversary, and apparently there's a conspiracy theory itself about the investigation of the Oklahoma City bombing, you know, kind of like some of the things we hear about a cover-up with the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
And apparently former Oklahoma Governor Charles Key is one of the proponents of this, but they actually were playing some news tapes, which I was surprised at, that were recorded live at the time of the bombing, that bomb crews had found two or three other unexploded bombs within the building itself. Have you looked any of this kind of stuff where they're talking about a cover-up of the investigation and other people being involved, that sort of thing?
Steve, thank you.
These are great questions, Steve. There has always been conspiracy theories around the Oklahoma City bombing, and that it was that the seismograph readings, for example, couldn't have been from what authorities claimed the blast was from. There's been no shortage of these things, but we are seeing a resurgence in these conspiracy theories about the bombing and supposed cover-ups and that sort of thing. A person would really, to answer those questions fully, a person would really need to be a federal investigator in to get down to the nuts and bolts of that whole thing. Keep in mind that when the trial took place, McVeigh's attorney argued that it was part of an international conspiracy, including nations such as Iran. So do I know whether that's true or not? Of course not. I don't know, I doubt many do, and I doubt McVeigh's attorney did at the time. But, you know, that's the role of a good defense attorney. You don't really have to prove innocence. You just have to put enough doubt in the minds of people. And in a country that's really prone to conspiracy theories, you know, that's not too hard to do. It's what got O.J. off, essentially, was this idea that there was a vast racist conspiracy against a wealthy, you know, black man who married a white woman. So conspiracy theories do a lot of bidding for a lot of people, Hillary Clinton being a very good example, as well as Michael Moore. So I wouldn't be surprised, Steve, if we see more questions about the investigation itself. And keep in mind, you know, that the world is not a clear-cut place many times. History, if it tells us anything, is that it often has untied ends. I personally wouldn't be surprised if they found some additional information that would be rather shocking with the Oklahoma City bombing. But would that prove that the United Nations and the Freemasons and the Federal Reserve and the U.S. media are all together trying to bring about the end of democracy and usher in the Antichrist New World Order? Of course not.
Okay, two quick questions, because the second one has to do with your forthcoming book, which sounds fascinating. But before that, can Christians dabble in these conspiracy theories with no consequences?
Well, that is an excellent question. I think that if their faith is really, really grounded, and they just read about these things out of curiosity, the way a person might look at a car wreck, for example, then I think they'd probably be all right. But I don't know how many people have really grounded faith in that respect. So my usual answer to that kind of question is, man, you've got better things to do with your time. You know, get more sleep, eat better, go exercise, go love your kids. These things really are a waste of our time.
Tell us about the book you're working on.
Working on a book right now. It'll be out in September, published through Bethany House. Dr. Laura Schlesinger has written a foreword to it. It's called No More Christian Nice Guy, When Being Nice Instead of Good Hurts Men, Women, and Children. Todd, you wrote an excellent article in Churches for Girls in the latest issues of Issues, Etc.'s journal. And I just laugh through it, because you and I must be reading each other's mail, because we really are tracking on this. And it's, you know, you've got some very funny lines in here. And so anyway, it's kind of down the track of what you have noticed as well. I'll back up a little bit. I refer to myself as a former Christian nice guy. I used to have a very difficult time with passivity and fear. And the book is about how I've overcame passivity and fear. And I tell you, Todd, if I can overcome you know, those things, anyone can. And it talks about the three major forces that created fear, at least in my life, a society that is prejudiced toward men, you know, men are jerks, all that sort of stuff, or selfish and all that, and then a religious underpinning that made Jesus look to be far more amiable and passive than what the gospel records really show. I contend that if Jesus were to come to an average church service today, we'd probably ask him to leave, given his manner and given the things that he actually said. And then number three, there's a psychology of passivity, which I know very well. I've had my share of difficulty, abuse and physical and emotional abuse as a kid.
You've got about 10 seconds here.
And so anyway, if people want to overcome fear and anxiety, they can pick up the book. It'll be out in September.
No More Christian Nice Guy?
That's it.
All right. Paul Coughlin, thank you for being our guest.
Hey, thank you.
Looking forward to reading the book. Paul Coughlin is a former newspaper editor and a radio talk show host. His book, Secret Plots and Hidden Agendas. When we come back, a Lutheran perspective on Benedict the 16th.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you find that you struggle for words when you pray? Are you unsure what to pray for? Do you fear praying for the wrong things? Do your prayers lack focus and direction? Do you feel unworthy to approach God in prayer? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April is a daily devotional titled, The Lord Will Answer. This resource presents prayers in one-page, easy-to-use devotions. The Lord Will Answer is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse on our website, issuesetc.org. The Lord Will Answer explains the six R's of prayer: recite, read, reflect, repent, rejoice, and request. The Lord Will Answer costs $14.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. The Lord Will Answer, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April.
Animals on the Ark. Here, kitty, kitty.
Answers with Ken Ham, president of the Bible-upholding ministry of Answers in Genesis. So, Ken, are you saying that Noah had to call all the animals to get them on board the ark?
Well, Mark, it wasn't quite like that. You know, the answer's found in Genesis 6, which says, "Of fowls after their kind, cattle after their kind, every creeping thing on the earth after its kind, two of every sort shall come to you to keep them alive." This verse tells us that Noah didn't have to search for the animals, or even call them to board the ark. They just arrived two by two, as though they were called by some kind of homing instinct. You know, while this can't be explained by our understanding of nature, it's certainly not a problem for an infinite creator. But even today, there are many astounding things we don't understand about animal behavior, which we see in God's creation. Just think of the amazing abilities of Canadian geese when they migrate, the remarkable flights of monarch butterflies, or the annual migration of whales. You just can't understand these things apart from a supernatural creator. You know, when we consider the flood of Noah's day, you can't separate God's supernatural power from all that happened. He was in total control. After all, he's the master designer.
Does Ken Ham also believe that dinosaurs were on Noah's Ark? He'll give you the eye-opening answer in his free booklet, What Really Happened to the Dinosaurs? It's available on our popular website, AnswersRadio.com. Next time you're in front of your computer, go to AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. A myth that is often perpetuated in the media is that might makes right. According to this false notion, power has the ability to determine morality. For some, it is the power of the government. If the government says abortion is allowed, then it's okay. For others, it's the power of science. If we have the ability to clone humans, then that's what we should do. Just because we can do something doesn't mean we should. Christian discretion is called for in making moral decisions. Yet such discretion is woefully lacking in the plots of most sitcoms and reality shows. Jesus loves your children very much. He died on the cross for them. He also wants them to make good moral decisions. You can help them do that by teaching them that might doesn't make right. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute at cmli.org.
May April showers bring May flowers instead of feelings of regret that you haven't yet acquired the education you need for the career you want. Your best resource for information on how to go about getting that education is the Educational Opportunity Centers. EOC centers have free information on all forms of education for adults beyond high school. Call EOC now to find out which of the 7 metropolitan St. Louis centers is nearest you.
Here in the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc., we'll return to the subject we treated in the first 25 minutes. We're going to talk about the newly elected Pope, Benedict XVI, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, until this morning, and now he is Benedict XVI and the new Pope of 1 billion plus Roman Catholics in the world. We're going to be getting the reaction from our guest here, Pastor Paul McCain, answering a few questions, why he is guardedly pleased with the election of Ratzinger as the new Pope, and your reactions as well, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. today. Pastor Paul McCain is our guest. He's interim president and CEO of Concordia Publishing House. Paul, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. Good to be with you.
Your initial reaction to Benedict XVI as this choice this morning?
I have to say I was extremely pleased. Extremely pleased. And that might sound a little odd coming from a Lutheran pastor, but when I consider all the potential alternatives, I believe this is the right man for them at the right time. And may I say why?
Well, yeah. Give us some reasons why it pleases you.
Well, first of all, I have for years admired Joseph Ratzinger as a very conservative, articulate spokesman for Orthodox Christianity, and the word Orthodox used in a general sense, just, you know, the right thing to believe. He has really held the line for truly Catholic Christianity. And by the way, the Roman Church does not own that word. They have no monopoly on it. We share the word Catholic with them. So I admire the fact that this man has spent his most of his productive career, particularly at the Vatican, defending true biblical Christian teachings on, you know, some of the most fundamental points, God, Christ, things like this. Also, I'm very happy that the head of the church will continue to be a strident and ardent spokesman for the unborn. He will continue to defend the Christian church against the influx and ravages of relativism, which is what he spoke about in his pre-conclave speech, which was quite remarkable. I did not think he would be elected. I thought he would be perceived as too old and too divisive. But I think the fact that he was elected by a two-third majority of the cardinals speaks well for him.
Now, I have, of course, this morning, in preparation for the show, been all over looking for the various reactions, trying to get the big picture on this. And on a couple of chat rooms, I found it quite interesting. Chat rooms at which I do not participate, but simply observe, two different reactions. One is kind of the obsequious speak no evil, either of the Pope in death or the newly elected Pope. And the other seems to be on the other end of the spectrum is somewhat dismissive. Well, we got a new Antichrist elected today, and that's all the more we have to know about it. Is there a middle position that Lutherans in particular, it's an awkward moment for a new election of a Pope, that Lutherans can take?
Well, I think this is a very emotional issue for truly confessional Lutherans because it pains us to the core to be separated from the Roman Church. This has never been our desire. It was not our desire at the time of the Reformation. We were expelled, and because precisely we thought we were speaking up for Catholicism, for the true faith of the universal church. So I think the emotionalism and the negative emotionalism sometimes is caused precisely because it's so painful for us, because you know, it's like getting thrown out of your father's house in a sense when we actually feel that they're the ones who went off on their own. I believe it would be wrong to simply say, well, we have a new Antichrist. Of course, we do, as Lutherans, affirm the papacy is, as we can identify it today, the deeply anti-Christian force in the church, which is a profound mystery and probably worthy of a separate show. On the other hand, it would be wrong for us to simply say, oh, you know, like you say, speak no evil, see no evil, hear no evil. The Roman Church will continue to be the Roman Church. Ratzinger can be counted on, and this is what I like about him, he can be counted on to be truly Roman Catholic. There's no doubt, or should be no doubt in anybody's mind, where this man stands on a variety of issues, and I respect that. I said to somebody this morning, I have no problem with a Roman Catholic Pope being a Roman Catholic Pope. My deep sense of frustration and anger comes actually when Lutherans stop being genuinely Lutheran. Ratzinger himself challenged Lutherans once when he said, why should we take the Lutheran confession seriously when the Lutherans don't? And that's a real indictment of some of our brothers in the Lutheran faith. So I think there is a middle way. I think we must recognize that this man does represent a church body that still clings to the historic creeds of the church. We confess those in common with them, and we're grateful for that. On the other hand, we do have to recognize there is profound problems precisely at the very heart of the gospel itself, the doctrine on which the church stands or falls, justification by grace through faith alone on account of Christ alone.
So why do you prefer a pope who is truly Roman Catholic to one who is going to be willing to play fast and loose with the church's teaching?
Because I don't like anybody who claims to be representing a confessional position and continually tries to compromise it with me or tell me, well, that's what we used to believe, we no longer believe it anymore, you can't really be sure of anything anymore these days, so why bother? That's just simply not a biblical approach to truth. That is not a Christian worldview. So while I have profound disagreements with the Pope and the church he represents, I at the same time respect any man who very clearly asserts what he believes because he knows why he believes it and is confessing it because he believes it to be the truth. Now, there's a guy you can have an intelligent dialogue and conversation with.
We'll open up the phone lines for your reaction to the new Pope, Benedict the 16th, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address. Feel free to use that as well, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our guest is Pastor Paul McCain. He's interim president and CEO of Concordia Publishing House. Paul, here's something that was not mentioned, that you didn't mention, and it's, I don't know, for me, it is significant. I had a Lutheran pastor once say to me, and I always took it to heart, on the issue of women serving as pastors, mm-hmm. He said, the Roman Catholic Church is the Hoover Dam, holding back the culture's force. And our church body and the others that still hold to the historic practice of a male-only clergy are the little towns down at the bottom of the dam. If the Roman church capitulates, the culture will wash over us, and it will be over on that issue. Do you agree, and is it encouraging then to find in Ratzinger someone who is going to hold the line on an all-male pastorate?
Well, I have mixed feelings on that. I've recently read more about this, and I found that a number of years ago, a Roman Catholic study said that there basically is no scriptural support to oppose ordination of women. It is more a matter of sacred tradition. Now, you have to understand, for the Roman Catholic Church, sacred tradition is divine revelation, but I found that a little disturbing. I think it's a bit of an overreaction. We are already perceived by non-Christians, Roman Catholic and Lutherans alike, to be a bunch of cranks and weirdos. So I think we're already fighting the cultural tide. Oh, also, if Rome ever caves, we also have the Eastern Orthodox Church and all those brothers and sisters in Christ. But the fact of the matter is they are the biggest game in town. And people kind of, when they think of Christian, it seems anymore in the media, you've either got the hand-waving charismatics or you have Roman Catholic priests portrayed. So in the mind of the populace, because Rome is so huge and so large, like you said, over a billion people, I believe it is significant that they continue to hold the line on this biblical teaching that women are not given the office of the ministry.
What do you make of the reaction that has come already, and I think it'll probably get a little louder as the week goes by, from Western American and probably more liberal Roman Catholics who don't like the idea that a truly Roman Catholic pope has been elected here in Ratzinger, and I've heard it several times already in the media, he's too conservative. Do you find it ironic that you, a Lutheran, are happier with this pope than some American Catholics?
Well, he is a German pope, so I'll use a German word, Schadenfreude, which means taking joy in other people's miseries. That sounds terrible, but there's an element of this which I'm totally enjoying. I went to a Roman Catholic high school, and the theology taught there was quite liberal. It would not in any way be accepted by this man or his predecessor or even Vatican II, in my opinion. But I had to say, I had a smile on my face as I thought of, you know, Andrew Greeley getting this news, Newhouse just recently described him, the man who writes yet another bodice-ripping novel. I mean, these kind of liberal Roman Catholics who are just out of their own church's teachings must be absolutely having conniptions. I can only imagine. And, you know, it's well-deserved. And I hope this pope cracks down on the more liberal professors and priests in his church, and particularly in America. And the interesting thing to me is, I don't know if anybody watched a couple weeks ago, 60 Minutes had a wonderful report on these young conservative American men over in Rome studying to be priests. And they reminded me very much of the younger generation of Lutheran pastors. By and large, these men are gung-ho for good, solid, traditional Catholicism, just like our younger men are very much gung-ho for good, solid, traditional, confessional Lutheranism. So I have to say, I have a smile on my face at the thought of some of these liberals who've been blasting historic Christianity for years at their reaction to the news that Ratzinger was pope.
When so many churches, even Lutheran churches, are throwing out the historic liturgy, what does it say to you that Rome has selected a new pope who not only thinks highly but has written and gone to the mat highly over the historic liturgy?
Well, I have to say, I believe Ratzinger was a ghostwriter often for John Paul II and worked in collaboration with him. So I think we must understand that a lot of what we've read from John Paul II for 25 years probably was done in close consultation with, if not written in part, by Ratzinger. This man is a theological powerhouse, and I think you put your finger on it. I think it should say something to us that just at the time when a lot of our own Protestant brethren are kind of going down this odd a-liturgical path, here's a Roman Catholic church of a billion people affirming the historic worship practices of the church. And I think there was something, whatever you have to say about the Mass on TV, it was very powerful that this was a historic, you know, Christian Mass. This was a worship service that has been around in that basic form and shape for thousands of years. So maybe we'll all grow in our appreciation for historical worship and the liturgy.
We're going to hear some audio here in a minute from John Allen. He is one of the biographers of Cardinal Ratzinger. He's got a book called Cardinal Ratzinger, the Vatican Enforcer of the Faith, and he is also Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. And we'll be getting our listeners' response to that. I invite you to listen in as a listener too, Paul. But before we let you go, tell us about your blog. I was gratified to see that you actually put up one of my articles from the Issues Etc. Journal on your blog there very recently.
Well, it was very well done, Todd. You're a very good writer, and I'm not just saying that to ingratiate myself to you. It's absolutely true. World Magazine asked me to be one of their blogging pastors, which is a strange expression, but I have a blog site, B-L-O-G, and anybody can find it by going to Google or any search engine and typing in Paul T. McCain, or Paul McCain. It'll probably be one of the first things to come up.
And what will they find there?
Oh, they'll find this blog site, and I just have the opportunity to post basically whatever strikes my fancy. They encourage me to comment on trends, religious trends. They probably want me to do a bit more cultural commentary, but I find myself more attracted always to theological trends and how things impact the church. So that's what my site's about. And also, I'm very pretty clear that I'm a Lutheran pastor. I've got a Luther seal right at the top of the page, and I try to explain what Lutheranism is to non-Lutherans. And I find a great deal of interest in the historic Lutheran faith among other Protestants and even Catholics.
Herman's on the line from Illinois. Herman, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask Dr. McCain's views on the current Pope, previously Cardinal Ratzinger's views on Lutheranism, as he was the one at, I believe, at Augsburg, who was there with the signing of the what's called the joint document on the Declaration of Justification. What group of Lutherans does he see identifying Lutheranism today? The ELCA-led Lutheran World Federation, or the position that Dr. McCain and his church body represent?
Very interesting question, Herman. Thank you. Paul?
That's a very good question. I'm glad I have a chance to comment on that. Ratzinger was the one who was very clear that the joint declaration on the Doctrine of Justification changed nothing vis-a-vis Rome's position on justification. In fact, the Pope, no doubt with Ratzinger's help, clarified once again that the canons and decrees of the Council of Trent, a specific anathema against any view that holds that we are saved by grace through faith alone, is anathema. I know for a fact Ratzinger knows very well historic Lutheranism. He is aware of the more confessional Lutheran churches. He's specifically aware of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. During my last years serving with Dr. Berry, we had actually made contact with Cardinal Ratzinger in his role as basically defender of the faith, the head of the Congregation for the Defense for the Doctrine of the Faith, and we were engaged in a correspondence with him, and basically we're saying to him, we would welcome the opportunity to sit down and dialogue historic Lutherans to historic Catholics, and we for the life of us cannot understand why the Roman Church would be interested in continuing to dialogue with a church body that claims the name Lutheran and yet kills unborn children or pays for their murders, ordains women, and now, as we see coming, is about to allow exceptions for practicing homosexuals to be priests, and a Lutheran church that has abandoned its own confession. And that really resonated in the Vatican. Unfortunately, that didn't come to fruition because Dr. Berry died tragically too soon. But Ratzinger is very aware of Lutheranism, and he respects confessional Lutheranism. He disagrees with it, of course, but he can respect it. I think he has problems with the liberal Lutherans. But the Lutheran World Federation is a big name and represents a large number of churches, and I'm sure they'll continue to dialogue with them.
Paul, you said early on that you were pleased that the new Pope is unashamedly Roman Catholic. On the flip side, what's sad about this fact?
Oh, it is so painful. I went to a Roman Catholic high school, and I've been encouraged more recently by people to talk about it because I had the experience of developing deep friendships with Roman Catholic young people, and particularly with priests and monks and nuns who were my teachers and encouraged me actually to be a Lutheran pastor. They gave me Religion of the Year student award 2 years running. And, I mean, I developed a real fondness for them, but yet there is still at the heart of this system an anti-gospel twist. Right at the moment you think they're just going to articulate the gospel, they skew it away, and you're back to trusting in what you do, in your works, in your response to grace, and it's just deeply painful. So I take no pleasure in the fact that this man will continue to advocate what I believe is potentially damning doctrine. And I say that with all due respect from Roman Catholic friends. And we Lutherans do not believe we're the only Christians. We do not believe all Catholics are going to hell. Far be it from me to suggest that. but we do stridently disagree with how they articulate the gospel. We cherish it so much, as I'm sure they think they do, that we feel so strongly it has to be kept very clear. We're saved by Christ alone, through faith alone, by no works from within ourselves. So it's a real mixed feeling. It's a very painful situation.
Paul, before I let you go, we we were up in Auburn, Michigan. Is that the right town?
Yes, sir.
Where we were, and I had the pleasure of meeting your parents.
Well, there you go.
And in particular, your dad. I had to say this before we let you go. Told me, he said it in a very stern way. It's kind of intimidating. Told me and my producer Jeff to keep an eye on you. So
well,
we will.
I definitely need that. I thank my father for his concern.
Thanks for being our guest, Paul.
My pleasure. God bless.
You too. Pastor Paul McCain, interim president and CEO of Concordia Publishing House. All right, I promise this, and I think time will permit us to get to some of these cuts from John Allen. He is the author of a book called Cardinal Ratzinger. You will now know him from henceforth as Benedict XVI. It's a biography called Cardinal Ratzinger, the Vatican Enforcer of the Faith. And he had a few things to say about Cardinal Ratzinger before he was elected Pope, of course, not knowing that he would be elected Pope. And I will tell you at the outset here that John Allen did not consider Ratzinger a front runner. In fact, he said at one point in an interview I heard that Ratzinger has a very slim chance of getting the needed votes. Well, he was wrong on that, but I want you to hear the other things he had to say. He's Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. Here's John Allen talking about Ratzinger and his relationship to Pope John Paul II.
Ratzinger has been the architect of many of the most controversial aspects of John Paul's pontificate, from the crackdown on liberation theology in the 1980s, the struggle against the military dictatorships, which Ratzinger saw as a kind of Marxism in another guise. He was responsible for the battle in the 1990s against what's known as the theology of religious pluralism, this idea of trying to see other religions as vehicles of revelation and ultimately of salvation. And conservatives in the church would see all of that as a necessary struggle against confusion and dissent. Obviously, other sectors of opinion in the church would see it as an unacceptable kind of rigidity, almost a Catholic form of fundamentalism.
In fact, that's exactly what I heard earlier today. They were, I think National Public Radio was doing some Catholic on the street reaction. Of course, when you've got white smoke coming out of the chimney and you don't know who the next pope is, and then after the pope comes to the window and you know who he is, you want to get all sorts of reaction. Well, National Public Radio was doing some of that today. And they were talking to some people back here in the U.S., men and women, and I was surprised. Even the young people, a 19-year-old guy said, well, I'm disappointed. He's too conservative. Ratzinger is, that is. And one person did even use the term fundamentalist, which, if you really understand the term fundamentalist, cannot in any shape, matter, or form be applied to a Roman Catholic. But this is how he's viewed. Why? Why, I ask you? Is it because he's hyper-Catholic? Is he Mel Gibson Catholic? I heard someone use that term. Are you Catholic? Are you Mel Gibson Catholic? No. Ratzinger simply is, he's a by-the-book Catholic. If it says, if we say this is what we believe and teach, this is what I'm going to believe and this is what I'm going to teach. Now, it's a sad commentary on the state of the church today that anyone who says that, whether they be Lutheran, Catholic, Methodist, anything, will get the label fundamentalist with all the negative connotations that go along with it. Here's John Allen again, a biographer for Cardinal Ratzinger and a correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter, talking about Ratzinger's role up until now.
He is someone who has never been shy about confronting what he would see as the forces hostile to Christianity at loose in the world. And I think his message was that the church faces serious dangers in this world, and it ought not to be unprepared to face them.
Now, as to those dangers, Ratzinger has an interesting way of looking at this. And I want you to listen carefully, because this may tell you about the future of Christianity, or at least the future of the Roman Catholic Church under this Pope Benedict XVI.
He has said many times that at least in Western Europe, and for that matter perhaps in the developed world, Christianity in the short term is going to have to become smaller in order to be faithful. I mean, he talks about Christianity as a creative minority.
Now, that's interesting. And you know what it flies in the face of? And I don't know that Roman Catholic parishes buy into this to any great degree, but I'll tell you what, Protestants sure do. That flies in the face of the church growth movement. Here we've got a Pope who says, and has said, you know, Christianity might have to get smaller to remain faithful. The exact opposite of that is being promoted among, in particular, American Protestants. Well, we've got to be less faithful to get bigger. Couldn't be a greater contrast. Should we think of Benedict XVI, should we think of him as a hardliner? Here's what John Allen had to say.
Like so many labels, calling Ratzinger a hardliner captures some degree of truth, but by no means all of it. The truth is, Ratzinger is an exceptionally supple thinker. I mean, he's one of the most talented theologians of his generation, and I think anyone, whether they agree or disagree with him, would agree with that.
You know, I don't think it's going to hurt anybody to have a theologian as a pope. Someone who actually understands his church's theology, can articulate it, and can defend it. I don't think it's going to hurt anybody. In a Catholic sense. That is it bad for the Catholic Church that they have someone who actually believes what they say they believe? And who understands it, and who can articulate it, and who can defend it? No. Would that more church bodies had theologians in leadership positions rather than simply bureaucrats. So finally, what can we expect according to John Allen, author of this book, Cardinal Ratzinger, the Vatican Enforcer of the Faith, what can we expect from this pope?
Ratzinger, on most theological issues, would defend a very conservative traditionalist position on the grounds that it is by clinging tenaciously to those conservative traditional positions that the church remains true to itself.
So we will wait and see exactly what will happen with Benedict XVI. And of course, as things happen, we'll continue to talk about it here on Issues, Etc. Tomorrow on the program, a 2-hour roundtable review of Joel Osteen's best-selling book, Your Best Life Now. Dr. Larry Rast will be our guest, and we'll also have Pastors Will Wheaton and Tom Baker for that 2-hour conversation. This is something you don't want to miss. When we did our review of Rick Warren's The Purpose-Driven Life, people kept coming back and again and again and again. I think it's still posted at our website someplace, that audio. We hope to do a repeat performance with Joel Osteen's book tomorrow on the program with Pastors Baker and Wheaton and Dr. Larry Rast, looking at that book, Your Best Life Now. And tomorrow we'll do the open line question that we didn't get to today. We'll do that open line question. If you're living in a small town and your church is hundreds of miles away, where do you commune? We'll talk about it tomorrow on Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.